Last week we began a series from the book of Philippians. That's why it's in your bulletin. And we covered the first 11 verses. And you can see we're going to try to cover the section of verses 12 through 20 this morning. Or we'll try to advance as much as possible. We gave you that out in case we go over time, or look like we will. We'll cut it short. This form of preaching has a way of taking you through contextual studies. Also, it makes the ensures a good, healthy investigation of the apostles' doctrine, you know, which is our primary purpose for being here. And kind of makes it sort of like a serial thing. You come back for, you know, what happens next week. So we're looking at in this particular study in the beginning of Paul's letter to the Philippians. He stated why he constantly gave thanks for the Philippians, especially in the confidence he felt in the completion of God's work in their lives, the fullness of his grace toward them to be reached, expanding their lives, making, you know, as they did in Paul's, and also how close they were to him, he says, in his very heart, because of their shared work in the defense of the gospel. In view of the latter, this defense of the gospel, Paul will now reveal what great news that he has. That in his long-awaited trial, his first hearing seems to have gone rather well. And he's going to expand upon this. And it is his hope that he can get on with the advancement of the Lord's work, not only here in Rome, but the Philippians and where they are and elsewhere. And it should be noted that Paul considers himself only a pawn in this endeavor, which is why so little is said about Paul. He kind of shies away from it, and he puts his emphasis really on the more important piece, that is, the gospel. So with that in mind, we'll start reading at verse 12, and Paul says, or writing, "Now I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel." Paul begins to inform them that what has become evident in his trial, in the word inform or know, he uses the present infinitive to convey the fact that this little bit of news is something that will affect the Philippians personally for a long time. His exciting information is that the things pertaining to his situation have gone rather well for the advancement of the gospel. And this word advancement in some translations, or here in ours, greater progress, literally means, I love the Greek in this because they call it Greek word pictures, because in this word is the picture of to administer a blow, to impel something forward. You know, all you golfers out there, you know, knock it down the range. So it's not only, you know, is the gospel allowed now, you know, through this to spread, but it's given it emphasis. You know, it's set it, you know, speeding out because of the effect that it's had through these trials and everything else. The circumstances concerning the gospel have been given a strong push toward the right direction. The result will be a window of opportunity that will allow the gospel to spread throughout the Roman Empire as a sanctioned religion. Before it was considered just a part of a cult of the Jews. Now it looks like it's going to stand on its own, and it's going to be acceptable, at least for about 10 years. Like I said, it's a window of opportunity, so those that are spreading the gospel will be able to do so unhindered, you know, because of the result of this trial. Okay. Verse 13 says, "So that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else." Now, as Paul states, this has had a dual result. First, that it's become well published. That's what you get out of well known. It's not just word of mouth, but it's getting out there. I mean, this is a major trial that's going on in Rome. And everybody's not only talking about it, but they probably put up circulars, whatever. This is going to be a major form of entertainment, you know, for everybody to come to. And that is, imprisonment was not the result of a criminal trial. I mean, this is what adds to it. He's not up there for criminal charges. He's up there for the cause of Christ. They really have no criminal charges against him. So, yeah, this is going to be fun for everyone. You know, bring the family, boys and girls, everything. Thus, the trial consisted of Paul's legal defense and the legal confirmation of the gospel of his Lord. Never has such a thing been heard in the trials of Rome. It aroused a large gathering in the courts. This was no small occasion. It is at this point that the Lord is keeping his promise to his disciples that the gospel will be witnessed to the uttermost parts of the world, which was just read by Phil. That's Acts 1:8. In fact, the terminology uttermost parts for the Jews had a reference to Rome itself. So Judea, Samaria, and then as far as Rome, and this is God fulfilling that promise. In particular, Paul is to fill his commission as a chosen instrument of God to bear his name, therefore, before the Gentiles. This is Acts 9:15. Also to kings, to Caesar himself, and to the sons of Israel. In Rome were seven large Jewish synagogues. Okay? And half of those, almost according to history, are going to be completely converted to Christianity through, you know, Paul's efforts at this time. Now, because of the special circumstance where Paul is not under criminal charges, it allows openness on the part of the Praetorian Guard. From the time of Tiberius to that of Vespasian, this guard consisted of nine cohorts of 1,000 men each. They were hand-picked bodyguards of the emperor. They were all Italian. They received double pay, enjoyed special privileges, and every soldier ranked with centurions. So it didn't even matter if he was a private in the Praetorian Guard, he required the same respect of a centurion anywhere else. And, every emperor courted its favor because it was such a powerful influence of the state, and usually as they came into power, the Caesars would bestow big gifts upon or donations to the Praetorian Guard, especially in lieu of right after Tiberius when Caligula came to the throne. And just like, spent all the coffers in a year, you know, was, you know, absolutely crazy. It was the Praetorian Guard that went in when nobody else could and took him off the throne. And of course, as the soldiers will, they put Claudius they found hiding behind a drape, and they pulled him out and put him on the throne as a joke. It actually turned out to be a pretty good Caesar, but it was the Praetorian Guard that had that kind of power. So when the Caesars came in, you know, they kind of were very careful, you know, with these guys. And these are the ones that Paul is going to be associating with from over 2 years. Yeah. The prefectus of this guard had his office in the emperor's palace, and Paul may have been placed there in the guard room of the Praetorian cohort on duty for 2 years, day after day, soldier after soldier. They stood guard beside Paul in his rented house, and they would have become very familiar with this unique individual and the message of God. You know, Paul would have had a good, you know, rapport with him anyway, being a former soldier himself. And it seemed to have had a valuable influence as the guard became thoroughly conversant with and interested in the case of Paul and the gospel. When Paul adds, "and to everyone else," this cannot mean less than all of Rome. And since the imperial court acted favorably, all the publicity would have been favorable too. Now, he says, "Most of the brethren, trusting in the Lord because of my imprisonment, have far more courage to speak the word of God without fear." This is verse 14. Now, from this all had a good effect upon the brethren in the capital. Paul names the most prominent individuals in his letter to the Romans in chapter 16. Now, notice, as we get to the end of this letter, in the fourth chapter, in verse 22, Paul sends his greetings to those of Caesar's household. So it's not only is the gospel making inroads in converts among the Praetorian Guard, it's also making its way up into those surrounding Caesar as his personal family. Paul names two large groups from this special family, the households of Aristobulus and Nicresus. Okay, those were slave, you know, families that were serving the emperor, and they had been totally converted to Christianity and had their influence. It might also be added in the fulfillment of Paul's commission concerning the sons of Israel, that upon Paul's arrival in Rome in Acts 28:24, that a great many of the Jewish leaders and rabbis came to his house and entered into the faith. The apostle states that it was because of this great advancement in the word due to his imprisonment that the brethren became fearless, okay, daring to openly proclaim Christ and the cross. Verses 15 and 16 we're going to put together. Following this, Paul says, writes, "Some to be sure are preaching Christ, even from envy and strife, but some also from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel." So in this latter group, first of all, from this large group, there's a mixture. He already talked in verse 10, we covered it last week, about using that word alloy, something mixed with something else. And so as this effort is expanding, there's a mixture. And this is what Paul was praying against, that there wouldn't be this kind of mixture, that they become unalloyed. Okay? But right now, the problem is there. There's mixed motivation. Paul says that some of the brethren of two groups, one with grave faults, one with noble intents. The one group, because they're envious of Paul, are driven to be contentious and really to thrive on dispute. They want to argue. It's a good way of getting yourself out there and becoming self-important. Their meanness had become great, possibly because the latitude of the gospel was now opening up, and they could freely go out into the towns and stuff and proclaim it. These may be individuals who have not received the greater gifts, whose influence had waned, and they felt thrust to the back, and now they're clawing, just like the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They could carp, they could find fault, they could raise strife, they preach Christ boldly only to seize the limelight. Interestingly enough, though, Paul still considers them brethren, probably in the hope that they'll come around. Okay. The other group, in contrast, conduct themselves with a noble and magnanimous spirit of goodwill, or free determination, promoting what is right in an honorable manner. This latter group, inner motivation, is love from an understanding and purpose enlightenment by a comprehension of what Paul is. He's an apostle. This is his office. It's something that's anointed, is appointed by God. As we come out, and they understand this. They know his imprisonment is part of God's plans. And so they don't look down on Paul because of his situation. In essence, they know what he is trying to do, and they go along with that. And we talked about they're working beside him for the promotion of the gospel. Okay. So verse 17, then he goes to the other group. He says, "The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, rather than from pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment. These announce, proclaim Christ through," he says, "selfish ambition." The sense of the word meaning to work for wages with a mercenary spirit that desires quick returns. Okay, they're out there for themselves. Their motives are mixed, impure, alloyed. They even believe that the progress in their preaching would cause Paul distress. That is, see, we're making inroads and you're confined. We hope that bothers you. You're bottled up and can't do anything, where we're free to get all this attention. They believed him to be like them, and he immediately shows that he's not. In verse 18, "What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in this I rejoice. Yes, I will rejoice." They were wrong when it came to Paul. For him, it was not a matter of who was asking or who was making more points. Rather, it was the accomplishment of the gospel's spread outward. That's the only thing that mattered to him. I mean, they were still preaching the gospel. Whether they're getting personal gain from it or not really didn't faze him personally. He was just delighted that the gospel was getting preached. He kept his mind on the important thing. He did not confuse the substance with the motive, because the main object was being handled. However, it does not mean that Paul condones in any Christian improper methods or motives. This is the apostle who states to the Ephesians in Ephesians 4:15 that the truth should be spoken in love. Peter, in 1 Peter 3:15, says that it must be presented with meekness and fear. James warns, in to the point here, where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. So as far as God's concerned, yeah, we do have to be careful of our motives. Yeah, it's nice that the gospel is preached, but we have to be careful. You know, as we're preaching the gospel, are we doing it for the right reasons? We're going to be held accountable for it. Because when James says, when there is this selfish ambition, there starts to creep in all sorts of disorder, the strife, the divisions, whatever, and then follows every evil thing. Paul by no means applauds the inner motivation of these hypocrites. Rather, he's being long-suffering, hoping that they will get over it and, you know, come into, you know, a work for the Lord that is, again, unalloyed. And then verse 19 says, I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of Jesus. Paul now affirms why he rejoices. There is to be a consensus among... In this is rejoicing. Yeah, he says, for I know it's turned out for my deliverance. The word literally can be translated salvation. But if you take it as, you know, his eternal salvation, that's not where he's getting at. I had to check this among a lot of scholars, because I didn't get it on my first reading. But most of them point out that what Paul has done here is he's exercising what they call intertextuality. Okay, we'll explain. it's a reference to something else, hoping that you'll get the big picture. To give an example, say if you had somebody come up to another person, and they're trying to tell them something, move something, get something across, and the person being addressed just turns to them and goes, "Frankly, Scarlett." Doesn't even have to be the full thing. Yeah. Do you know how the rest of the quote goes? Okay. Do you know what the circumstances are? Have you seen Gone with the Wind? Okay. All you have to do is just make a brief reference, and you get the whole picture. Okay. And that seems to be what Paul is doing here. This is a direct quote from Job. Okay. Directly from the Septuagint, the Greek translation, Job 13:16. Where the term salvation, deliverance is used, but there in the sense of vindication. So all he's done is make a quick reference, you can barely notice it unless you really know the scriptures, the whole movie, about Job. That, here's an individual that's undergoing some persecution, his best friends are saying, why has everything gone bad? Is it because of your sin? Confess your sin. And then maybe God will forgive you and everything will go away. And can you see that maybe this is what's happened with Paul? Paul's in prison. Even if it's for the cause of Christ, won't there be some people that kind of look at his imprisonment and go, why are you in jail? I mean, just the mere presence of being there, whether it's for a good reason or bad, has a kind of a stigma to it. And he is going, the way this is going to turn out is going to be a vindication, just as it is of Job. So just a quick reference to Job, and they get the whole picture. Okay, he's undergoing this for a testing, for a trial for the gospel, and it's not only Paul, but also the gospel that's going to be vindicated. Okay. Isn't the gospel also getting kind of a stigma here? Because it's being in court to see if it's going to be legal or not. And Paul's just excited. He says, I'm going to be vindicated, just as Job was. Isn't Job now known for his patience and his faithfulness to God no matter what? And Paul's looking for his and the gospel's vindication here also. So this is to be achieved by, and he gives credit where credit is due, the Philippians prayer of petition, okay, and whatever the Spirit of Christ can supply. Those two sources, okay, are going to bring about this vindication. This last may be understood, this part about the Spirit's part, may be understood in the Lord's own promise to his disciples that the Spirit would furnish them not only what to say, but also how to say it. Matthew 10:19-20, Luke 12:12. But here's probably one more to the point here in Luke 21, verses 14-15, where Jesus tells his disciples, so make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves. For I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. Perfectly fits into Paul's circumstance. Okay? So the Spirit is going to be there, and Paul doesn't even have to think about his defense. The Spirit's going to give him utterance. Make all those that stand against him and the gospel, you know, just to look, you know, like they have no evidence at all, which they don't. Okay, and then in verse 20, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that I shall not be put to shame in anything, but that with all boldness Christ shall even now, as always, be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. All this just stated, Paul says, accords with his earnest expectation and hope. Now, this word expectation, again, is one of those word pictures. It envisions a stretching forward of the head to view a thing's first appearance. Have you ever been, you know, standing, you know, on a corner waiting for a bus or waiting for somebody to pick you up, and you look down the street, you know, and the neck comes out, and you're looking for just the first indication of something coming? He says, and Paul says, this is the way I am right now. I'm waiting, you know, in this kind of stretched out position. And then he goes, you know, and this is coupled with hope. In the New Testament, hope reflects the highest degree of certainty about the future. You know, it's not just like a wishful thinking. You know, hope, you know, the Hebrew writer says we have a hope as an anchor because there's a certainty about it. And what he's hoping is that he'll not be put to shame in anything, but will be exalted and magnified. This might, too, be borrowed something from the poor man in Psalms 34. Okay, same circumstance. Thus, Paul's confidence is that the Spirit will not let him deport himself in any way to bring reproach upon the name of the Lord. This is what, you know, he's looking for, this guarantee, really. You know, this is where it's headed, and this is what he's anxiously, you know, expecting to happen. Not just wishing, expecting to happen. This is why he's writing such a hopeful letter to the Philippians. Okay. And then it talks about this word, with all boldness. This emboldened parousia means in public. You know, to be able to talk about it in public, him the freedom of speech that is not cowed by fear or consideration of the safety of his own person, whether he's threatened, you know, to have a worse life or a sudden death, none of that matters. And he's looking to God to help him, embolden him, to be back out in public, especially, you know, before his trial, you know, when he's going to have a big audience, and to be able to defend the gospel. Okay, just summing this up as a way of an invitation. And mark this date, I'm getting you out of here early. For all those times we went 5 minutes over, 10 minutes. Okay. First of all, there's much to be revealed here. You know, I mean, to be pulled out. I mean, just things that are just monumental, especially if they affect us. There's the spectacular display of the gospel before the Roman world and its favorable acceptance. I mean, it's what Paul told the Greeks. These things weren't done in a corner. Okay, and God is making sure it's not swept under the rug now. Even more boldly, before the world as a theater, really, this is going on. You know, take in the spectacle of it. There is recorded the great effect it had upon one, the Praetorian Guard, the emperor's personal guard, and upon even Caesar's household. Okay, people were listening to what was going on, and they were believing it. They were becoming converts. I think it was Fox's Book of Martyrs, writes about a whole Roman legion that became Christian during this period of time. In fact, why it's in that book is because also to a man, even though it was a highly decorated unit, refused to bow down and worship Caesar, and they were all executed to the man. There's the boldness that comes from an increase in faith at the wonder of God working against the world, even the highest of places. This is what we see. Sometimes it doesn't dawn on us looking at the Old Testament, that God works not in like little cubby holes or places out of the way. We see his people in the very hub of civilizations, the mightiest empires. You know, whether it's the Chaldeans or it's in Egypt among the pharaohs, in Persia, the Babylonians, whatever. You know, God is always up there in the upper branches even. You know, where his people even become like second or third in power of some of the mightiest kingdoms in the history of the world. Okay? And it's finding the same effect here among the Roman Empire. You know, Roman Empire was bigger than the United States. Okay? We think ourselves as being mighty. Roman Empire was a lot larger. And actually, pound for pound, probably more powerful. Okay? It was having its effect. There's also the caution that needs to be considered by Christians as to what their true motives are in the defense and proclamation of the word. That we need to keep our motives pure and unalloyed, because we're going to be judged on that. Not in the fact that we preach the gospel. There's some kudos that go with that and souls that come with it. But you know what Paul's concern was, that he buffets his body, brings it in subjection, lest after he preached to others, he himself might be a castaway. So even as we look to take, you know, with boldness the gospel out there, make sure we do it in the right spirit with the right motives. Okay? Or we're going to save a lot of souls and not our own. Okay? There's the knowledge that we need to pray for one another and to pray for the progress of the truth in this world, and to look confidently that the Spirit will supply what he will, you know, in the efforts of our lives. And there is the example of Paul's commitment to the truth. That whether by our lives or by our deaths, we be found vindicated in our work for God. No matter what happens, we could be getting to a point where you have to take a stand for the, you know, for the gospel against this government. It could happen. Yeah. Scary, but don't let it be scary. You have your faith resolved. Stand firm. There's going to be a stigma with it. When you take a stand for the truth, and you may have to go to jail for it. Okay? I may have to go to jail for it, you know, because the government's already telling me not to preach certain things from the pulpit. There's going to be a stigma with it. There's going to be a stigma. Try to get a preaching job, you know, and let them know on your resume, oh, by the way, I did some time in jail. Sometimes they don't ask you, what were you there for? You know, they say, oh, okay. So there's always going to be that. Don't let it be a problem. Okay? This is why you find when something really gets important. What are you willing to lose in order to stand up for what's right? That is the big question. Okay? It may come to a point where for making the right decisions, you may lose a good life. You may lose life itself. But that's how you know whether what you're standing for is really important and worth it or not. What are you willing to pay for it? With that in mind, okay, what is God offering you? Okay, a chance to be with him. Like we're studying, like in Sunday nights, the things that the Psalms, you know, put there for us, a life in service to God that finds its reward not only here, but also ad infinitum in time to come. Okay, and truly, as it's termed, it is life itself. There really is no other alternatives, no other choices. I mean, the world may look good, but it's all futile, it's all pointless, it's all dead ends. and it gets tired and old real fast. What God has given us are the things that are good for us, that make life better, that make life eternal. And he constantly puts out there the invitation to make the right decision. I mean, this is what makes a good life, making right decisions along the line. And as we're about to sing song number 293, notice it not only gives you an invitation, but it tells you when to do it. Today. Today is the only time you're promised. Won't you come as we stand?